Listening to Jean Rossman. I'm sorry, I can't.
It's Jen, Jen, but that's
cool. Huh? Jen.
Yep.
Jean. Oh, this,
no, Jen.
Oh, Jen. It shows. Well, anyway, listening to you reminded me of what Larry has said several times, which sort of got lost. He says, how do you build engineering content into liberal arts courses? So you could have a history of the West or whatever, mm-hmm. with engineering achievements along the way, which makes crucial differences. You could have a political discussion, the history of Chinese water. Is it Chinese water, which is, there's a famous book, Oriental Despotism. Which is about Chinese water projects, if I'm not incorrect. And the point about it is that that point that Larry made several times is, there are two issues floating around. One is about the degrees and programs and so forth. And then that more, restricted issue. And what was interesting about Jen's description was it sounded like you were addressing making those liberal arts courses engineering rich. And I thought that was distinctive of all the discussions here.
Thank you. Did you want me to say more about our courses? Well, I never turned down a compliment, so I'll thank you. I would say that what I tried to talk about was sort of two flavors of things that we do, which is engineering courses that have lots of social context and also involve writing and other things that are humanities and social science, and also courses coming from the humanities and social science perspective that have lots of technical content. And so we do try to do both of those. Agreed. It would be awesome to be a Billington. I would like that. Or
okay. Excuse. Okay. Thank you. Okay.
So Terry Bristol, Portland State University. I just wanted to comment a little bit on the arts thing, just resource wise. There's a book by a guy named Donald Norman, who was a major design guy in Silicon Valley, and he has a great TED talk if you want to look it up. Which he starts out and he says, the greatest design, he said, after 50 years of design, said, my number one criteria of a good design is how beautiful it is. And I think that mentality is really getting into the design thinking. Also, just like 2 or 3 days ago, Walter Isaacson, who wrote this book on Einstein, another one on Steve Jobs, and a new one out just called The Innovators. And someone asked him in this book deal, they said, what's your next project? He goes, well, I don't really know right now, but he said, I think it's going to be about engineering and art and the integration of those. He says, I think they're the same thing somehow and they should be in the one other comment, sort of like, do we want to include everything beside arts? There's a book that everybody here ought to read and probably haven't. It's a book called Knowledge and the Wealth of Nations, a guy named David Warsh, W-A-R-S-H, who was an economics editor for Boston Globe for years. And it's about a guy named Paul Romer, and it's about a paradigm change in economics from scientific economics to basically saying economics is an engineering enterprise. And I think it's just like absolutely fundamental to everything we're talking about here. And the other E that's missing in all this discussion is economics. And Romer's whole thing is just to say, wait a minute, invention isn't external to economics, which it is in scientific economics. It's actually part of what economics is all about. It's about invention, it's about development and so forth. Anyway, Knowledge and the Wealth of Nations, highly recommended.
Thank you. One over here.
A question for, this is Gary Downey, question for Jennifer. What's a module? What sorts of learning materials are included in these modules? What sort of teaching materials? Any guidelines for instructors? Any evaluative materials? Have you done any work in measuring student learning? What's a module?
Great question. So we have kept an open approach to what a module is, but what I've tried to do, I'll use the Three Gorges Dam module as an example. What we did was create a set of materials that included an overview of the issues of the Three Gorges Dam, that included some primary materials that the instructor could use, plus abstracts and how they could use it. For instance, the report on megadams by the World Dam Commission, as well as the Chinese government's, central government's report on the Three Gorges Dam, so they could, the students could understand the Chinese perspective as well. We created assignments that tried to get to some of the big issues behind the Three Gorges, environmental, societal. We had interviews available for the students by some of China's more famous environmental dissidents, like Dai Qing, she's a journalist. And there's a book that she published outside of China before she was removed from the public scene that really talked about the impact at the local level. So we're trying to gather a whole bunch of different types of materials for the students together so they can get an idea of how China presents its case for the Three Gorges Dam, including the website, which is quite interesting if you want to dissect a piece of government information from a private corporation. And so I pulled all that material together and worked with the instructors to try to create a space where the students could address this concept of mega dams through the Three Gorges Dam, which is a totally different societal context. These professors can do what they want with the material. So the first time they used it, they had it as an out-of-class assignment, because the students had to address all sorts of power issues and energy issues all over the world. The second time they used it, they incorporated some of the material into class. So that's what we want, right? And we want it to be part of the actual milieu, if you will, and that they're incorporating them into the class. We gave them assignments, and I did give them some evaluative materials. This is all in process. We've only been doing this a year or two, and as everyone has pointed out, it takes a long time to move anything through the academic scene. So I'm hoping to get more materials into the classrooms. For some of the other modules we've created, it's been more of a repository of information that the professor can use if they would like. For instance, we had a module on materials, cement really, for a civil engineering class that looked at a lot of different types of construction projects in China, because China does things on a scale that would never be allowed in this country. We have too many regulations. And so the instructor for that course, Professor Tahar Al-Khorchi, was fascinated by the technology used for allowing cement to be used in the Hangzhou Bay, like with the salt water and everything. So we created some assignments around that. And we have a website, actually, for that module that goes through a lot of these different mega projects and the types of engineering that were used and the types of questions that had to be addressed to allow the scale of the projects to go forward. One of the projects, which has not actually moved forward, is an apartment complex that will house 100,000 people in Chongqing. And it creates its own city, if you will, or village in Chinese terms, in a single building that it has to include hospitals, grade schools, supermarkets, everything. You don't have to leave your complex. Now, that to us doesn't sound very appealing, but because of China's air pollution and water pollution, people are looking for these insular types of living environments where they can be more assured of clean air, filtered air, clean water. And so these are the types of issues that we can bring in through the modules that our students as Americans wouldn't necessarily be thinking about. And it helps them understand why China approaches its own grand challenges with a different model, which is a top-down technocracy. Let's do something big. Let's do it grand. Let's push the envelope, because our challenges are bigger than anyone else's.
Great. So. Thank you.
I'd like to respond to that question, too, if that's
okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So Jennifer is talking primarily about content, and I would add to that a module needs to have the ability to be implemented systematically in a variety of contexts. And also, I think it has to have some assessment component, that it has to have been tested to figure out if it achieved the goals that it was set out to do. if you look, and this goes back to what I was talking about discipline-based education research, modules are all over the place there, and we really have to draw from that model and to make sure that if we are going to create modules, that they're based on sort of best practices, and they have to include those two components.
Great.
Harry, if I may just put a plug in for Adam Wells, who's from Emory and Henry, and they're working on I don't know how far along you are, but grab Adam if you want to talk about this, but modules on how to bring science and technology into some humanities courses, and I know it's a project that's just starting. I think it's supported by Teagle as well, but you should add it. I just met Adam today, but he's got some really interesting insights on how this might work. So
It would be great if little references like that can get pulled together in some form where those of who didn't hear the names distinctly, and I hear lots of people nodding, can look up those resources. That would be terrific outcome of this meeting. Do you have a question over here?
It's a comment.
Go ahead.
It's a note of appreciation, and I just want to say thank you to Jennifer and Jen, and I have something that connects your two things, which is that back in 2006, Henry Petrosky gave a lecture at ASEE on the value of engineers learning history, and at the end of that talk, I asked him a question because I was teaching the Warmth Disperses book in my thermal class at Smith, and my students were very quick to say, well, wait, these are contributions from French, German, and English men in the 19th century. This is really specific. What's the rest of the contribution on the record from China, from India, from Africa? Where is it? And I hired a student over summer to do some of that work, but really all that revealed to me was the need for scholars in East Asian studies and in African studies and so on to actually collaborate on that work. And I asked the question to Petrosky, and he said, shockingly, I mean, the room gasped when he said, the contributions of the Chinese have been greatly exaggerated. So thank you for revealing the lie in that. So thanks for that. I also, if I may, announce that there is a new solicitation out from the National Science Foundation. It is number, write it down, 15-539. It is called Professional Formation of Engineers, Research Initiation in Engineering Formation. And this is the second funding opportunity that's being offered under this rubric of professional formation of engineers, which refers to the formal and informal processes and value systems through which people become engineers. It also includes the ethical responsibility of practicing engineers to sustain and grow the profession. According to Michael Fabre, to form is more ontological than to instruct or educate. So this is the difference between professional formation and engineering education. To form is more ontological than to instruct or educate, for one's entire being is at stake. And I credit Gary Downey with that translation. Processes of formation are holistic, carefully attending to how knowledge and personhood interrelate in the larger context of one's life. And it goes on, but there is not time. So 15-539. So there's opportunities there for us to do what we're talking about doing there in that. And just ask me if you want to know how.
Great. Thank you.
Deadline is April 30th, 2015.
Great. Thank you so much. Yes, sir.
So this question,
identify yourself.
My name is Brad Kallenberg. I'm at the University of Dayton. My question is basically to Jennifer, but Rudolph, but maybe the entire panel. I'm wondering if you intentionally deal with students having negative assessment of Chinese technology because they're using concrete and salt water, that sort of thing. Do you undertake to try and counter that, students walk out of the classroom saying those stupid Chinese or whatever, you know what I'm saying?
Yes. He has become one of my favorite students at WPI, was initially just the biggest thorn in my side, because for him, he's like, why do we have to study China? In fact, he signed up for two of my classes at different times and dropped them both because he's like, China, really, who needs it? Because the U.S. is where science and engineering education is, and he's from Eastern Europe. And I actually advised him in Costa Rica on the junior year project where he had to do a feasibility study for a wind farm. The students did a good job, but they were doing their final presentation to the utility in Costa Rica, and the one guy from the utility company said, yes, but did you consider the Chinese? Because they are doing all sorts of things with these turbines, you know, using bamboo blades and blah, blah, blah. And from that point on, the student was like, okay, So I guess China has something. So that is a prejudice that we do deal with regularly in coming up with these modules. But I think that's one of the real values in taking this approach, is that the students have to encounter what other places have done. I'll put on my soccer mom cap for a second. I live in a town that is just full of engineers and IT professionals from around the world. And talking on the sidelines one day to a civil engineer from Algiers, we were talking about engineering education, and I said, you know, it's my perception that it's all U.S.-based. And she said, oh, thank you for saying that. You know, when my education back home, we had case studies from all over the world, and I don't see that here. And that was one of the things that actually got me thinking about this was, you know, why don't we have this? And I think in part because there is that bias you just addressed. And, you know, I think that's changing, especially in the case of China, as they take the lead in certain types of green energy and solar energy. But certainly we don't appreciate the gains and accomplishments of many cultures around the world, not just China. So I think it is something we should take on and force our students to realize that we're not the end-all here in the U.S. Certainly we have lots of accomplishments, but they'll be much richer in terms of their own thinking if they can comparatively assess the situations in the U.S.
Anybody else have questions or comments? Yes, sir, right here. Sure. Were we going to get a comment from another panelist?
Oh, I was just going to agree with Jennifer.
Please.
And point out that I think engineers benefit from those discussions of technological culture. And we've had, in my courses, very fruitful discussions of, for example, the Dutch versus the American approach to flood prevention, and how it's really based on sort of societal values that the Dutch took the approach that we're all in it together, and it's a collectivist policy, and we're all going to take the hit together, and so we will all bear the costs and think about the management together, rather than the American mind view, which is all often in the wake of a tragedy to say, oh, why did those silly people live there where they had the risk of that? And that actually ends up casting Americans in less than positive light. But I don't think any of these modules or discussions or ethics or whatever should ever end with sort of a neat, this was the right approach or this was the wrong approach or this culture wins this today. So I think acknowledging the complexities in all of the technological cultures is definitely fruitful. And that's all I wanted to say.
Yes, sir.
Could
you identify yourself for those who...
Hello?
Yes, could you identify yourself?
Oh, John Haywood, University of Dublin.
Thank you.
I want to ask a question, but I need to preface my remarks with a statement, otherwise the question doesn't make sense. Many, many years ago, the Institution of Mechanical Engineers in London required all people seeking professional membership to have passed an examination in the engineer in society. And they wrote a syllabus for this, and it covered everything from history, economics, personal relations, organizational behavior, and so on and so forth. And I can't remember the time that they allowed for it, but it was somewhere around 30 hours. Now, this meant that we had to look at some way of linking these together, hence the term was used transdisciplinary, and it went alongside the engineering, and it was not, as Professor Bucarelli is seeing, as it being integrated within engineering, although of course many of the examples you use come straight across, but it wasn't intended to have that level of integration, but it was intended to be integrated. Now, the problem is this. The Institution of Mechanicals, as do most engineers in England, think that history is linear, and that you get one improvement, and then there's the next improvement, and so on and so forth. It just isn't like that. And the question comes, how, in a very restricted, you could say that we built up a course of modules to meet this 30-hour requirement, is if you are going to treat these subjects and what they can offer you as different ways of thinking, the psychology of organizations, the social structure, and these things, different ways of thinking, The danger is, in the language that you are using this afternoon, that you lose the integrity of the disciplines. Now, you've been very anxious about the integrity of engineering, but you haven't been anxious about the integrity of all the disciplines you think should be contributing to engineering. Now, this raises a very important question, because our discipline's theory, as I understand it, goes back to Plato, and we're still stuck with it. But recently, in some ASEE conferences, people have begun to look, say, at engineering education as a discipline, and this has made me wonder whether, in fact, the growth of knowledge has not actually demolished the discipline theory, and that what we talk about are areas of knowledge. Now, if you do that, that not only has implications for what you're calling the social sciences and the humanities, it also has implications for engineering. And it means that you start from an entirely different philosophical base. So my question is, how do you preserve, or how do you know when you're breaking the integrity of subjects in the humanities, the arts, and the social sciences?
Thank you. In 3 minutes or less. Actually, less than that, because there's one more question waiting. So,
I know it when I have 14 faculty members lined up in my office, all at each other's throats, I guess. But it's a really good point. And I think one of the pushback that we do get from the social sciences humanities, when we start pushing and saying, hey, we got to integrate in with the technical disciplines, they say, well, you know, philosophy in and of itself is a noble area of study and a noble discipline to study, and not everything has to have these technical dimensions welded into them. The other thing that folks need, I know you know this, right, but the universities in the States all have their general education curriculum that may be different than in Europe. In New York State, for example, every student, every engineering student, at least 20-25% of their coursework comes from the social sciences and humanities. So we have an opportunity to touch them outside of all this integration and allow them to get minors in music, for example, without having to force engineering and music together in that way. But
I was actually get back at you and say that you want integration, and integration is a desirable thing as far as I can see.
You know, and not everyone agrees with that, I suppose. There are traditional disciplinarians who, or they believe that integration will happen more naturally and that you don't have to force it.
Okay, we're going to have a, this sounds like a cocktail hour question, actually. So that'd be, you've queued up a good one for afterwards. And I think we got one more, time for one more question. What, a quick question and a quick answer, and I think we can stay on schedule.
All right, quick. Drew Guspa from Smith College. This gets to your point earlier about the tension you've seen between some of the humanities faculty and engineering and the legitimacy of engineering as part of the liberal arts. And Joe, you mentioned that your students can take engineering courses and it counts as part of the general requirements. Jen, you said engineering is part of the liberal arts. I'm wondering if your college sees it the same way, that engineering can count as part of the core distribution requirements, and just thoughts generally about how engineering is perceived as being part or not being part of the liberal arts.
At Lafayette, the engineering can count toward the common course of study requirements for all students in a couple of different ways. They have to take a certain number of courses outside their own major discipline and major division. And there are also a few places, like there's a science, technology, and social context requirement for non-engineers, for example, that an engineering course could count for. Whether my whole institution views engineering as a liberal art is an excellent cocktail party question.
All right. Any other quick ones? No?
Well, that in New York State, so you cannot use professional programs to meet general education requirements. So engineering cannot count for gen ed. Business courses cannot count for gen ed. And so students are required to take social sciences humanities course to meet that gen ed requirement.
President Elliott is smiling down from the grave. Thank you.